50 years ago today, Apollo 11 launched from Cape Canaveral. 4 days later, Neil Armstrong would walk upon the moon, and he wouldn't be the last Purdue grad to do so. Today, we explore not only Purdue's huge roster of astronauts, but Indiana's role in the U.S. space program. From making the fuel tanks for the lunar lander to amazing technology that could benefit heart transplant patients here on Earth. We'll cover it this hour on All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indianapolis Monthly's July issue covers the many ways Indiana has contributed to space exploration. Joining me live in the studio will be writer Adam Wren, deputy editor of Indianapolis Monthly Daniel Comiskey, and editor-in-chief Mike Rubino. We'll also hear from VP of Corporate Development for TechShot, headquartered in Greenville, Indiana, Rich Bowling, and Hoosier astronaut Charlie Walker, one of three astronauts born and raised in Lawrence County. We'll also take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana.
When I was at Purdue, one of my fraternity brothers, actually a pledge brother, was Neil Armstrong.
No kidding.
And
no kidding.
Of course, he wasn't the Neil Armstrong you know now.
Of course, but still.
But it was Neil Armstrong.
It was Neil Armstrong.
He was a pledge brother. And he would have taught me to fly.
No kidding.
And I could have rented a Piper Cub at the airport at Purdue for $5 an hour. But the way my dad felt about airplanes, I just didn't feel like I could spend his money doing that.
Yeah, okay.
And I really wish I had.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Neil, he could fly anything upside down or right side up.
Clearly.
And I would have loved to have him teach me how to fly. And he offered to do it. He said, I'll teach you how to fly. I said, I just can't spend my dad's money for that. He hates airplanes so much.
How much time do you spend with him?
With Neil?
Yeah.
Well, I lived with him for 3 years. So, yeah, a lot of time.
Wow.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser, and that was my friend Tom. I interviewed him once for a completely unrelated reason, and just before I was about to turn the microphones off, he drops that bomb on me. Just goes to show, here in Indiana, we have a surprisingly strong history and connection to space exploration. And that is just what Indianapolis Monthly wanted to highlight in its July issue. This hour, we're delighted to have Deputy Editor Daniel Comiskey. Daniel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Editor-in-Chief Mike Rubino. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
And, of course, we welcome your comments and questions on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at All In Indiana. Mike Rubino, what were some of the surprises that you uncovered as you were getting this thing all put together?
Well, I knew that Indiana had roots that went pretty deep when it came to space exploration. So that was known to me. But I think in working on this, I really started to feel it. I wasn't alive when Apollo 11 happened. My memories of space are probably different than my parents or space exploration. In working on this, I really felt a sense of pride in my state and in the people, the men and women who worked on this project. And that's not something that I had felt or thought about before. And that's what was surprising to me. There are dozens of examples within the stories that we have in this issue that are surprising. But on a personal level, that was the most surprising to me, that I felt so attached.
I think the deep roots that most people think of with respect to Indiana's role in space exploration come from knowing that Purdue is the cradle of astronauts. And probably for most people, it doesn't go beyond that.
Absolutely.
The deep roots that you're referring to, though, were what?
Manufacturing.
Yeah.
In helping put together this issue, one of the things that we stumbled upon were some old news clippings from 1969. The governor at the time had an Apollo 11 day, and it wasn't just for Neil Armstrong. It was for all the men and women who had contributed to the little things, the manufacturing side of it. And to me, that was a little bit of an eye-opener. I knew Purdue was the cradle of astronauts. I knew Gus Grissom went to school there. I knew he was from Mitchell, Indiana. I knew all that stuff. But what I didn't know was just the amount of small to mid-size companies throughout the state that really contribute to this effort.
Aside from the 50th anniversary, which I think is the most obvious reason that you did this, what made you want to cover Indiana's piece of the space program?
Well, part of our mission, or a big part of our mission as a magazine, it's in a couple parts here. And the first part is we should surprise and delight our readers with every issue. And the second part is we need to, when we put out an issue, the overall goal is to examine what it means to be a Hoosier, or what it means to live in Indianapolis. And that's kind of an ongoing challenge that we have, or an ongoing opportunity. And so when we looked at the subject matter, that seemed to check off both of those boxes. You know, it was surprising. It's not something we've done before for obvious reasons. But it also dovetails pretty nicely in our overall mission of meditating on that idea of what does it mean to be from Indiana? What does it mean to be from Indianapolis? And how does that impact our daily lives or our psyche? You know, so that was why it was an obvious fit for me. Specifically, why did we do it? I think a couple years ago, I was actually listening to this very station, and I heard like a little piece, and I think it was Inside Indiana, and I heard somebody say something like, "The road to Mars runs through Indiana," and man, that just like waylaid me. I was in the car, I know exactly where I was, and that idea just kind of blew me away, and I filed it inside a little corner of my brain, and I just came back to it a couple years later whenever we sat down to kind of plot out what 2019 would look for us editorially. And it just so happened, oh, wow, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 is going to happen too. So it just seemed natural.
So then how early were you – was this a germ? Not just a germ, but how early did you start actually working toward this? This was the plan. I mean, was it
a year ago? Yeah. And that's it sounds like a lot, but that's not unusual. I mean, in a big picture way, we plot out a year in advance. And then there's all kinds of deadlines. So we're working at different time intervals. Sometimes it gets confusing to know what month you're in. Like we are living actually in July right now, but we are working on September issue. I had to think about that. But we'll also do planning meetings for November. And pretty soon here, we have to plan for 2020. So we're constantly, whether it's a short time deadline or a long term, we're constantly looking at what we've got right in front of our face and looking what we've got coming down a year from now.
So the issue's been out for a few weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten any feedback on the cover story, essentially?
Yeah,
without
a doubt.
Yeah,
absolutely. Everything's been positive. We like to hear all comments. So if somebody had a problem with it, they're more than welcome to email or call to. I'll listen to you. But overwhelmingly, it's been positive. People seem to love the cover, which I think is half the battle. A lot of times, and we can talk about that later. But I think it's very visually arresting, and it stops you, and it's just a beautiful piece of art. But then when you get inside, the content is really something that's special too.
And we want to hear from you if you've read the issue or the articles in particular that we're talking about. You can get us on Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also find us on Facebook at All In Indiana. So I personally am a huge space nerd. And so I ask this with love and reverence. Who among you is the space nerd between the two of you?
It's a close race. I've been fascinated by space since I was 5 years old and watched Cosmos. I think for a lot of people our age, that was the beginning. You know, Cosmos was such an amazing show. Carl Sagan was such an amazing visionary, and he had that talent for bringing all of that down to Earth so even a kid could understand it. And in talking with a lot of the astronauts that I talked with, of course, they're most of them a generation older than I am, but they caught the bug about the same age, very, very young. And wanted to be an astronaut from the time they were 6, 7, 8 years old. So that's my – how about you? How early were you interested in space?
I think I was interested when I can't remember the exact year, but I recall the – I have an image in my mind, and it was the shuttle piggybacking on a Boeing.
Yeah.
I assume it was a Boeing. It was a huge – aircraft. And I remember them taking it from one part of the country to the next. And it was in the middle of the afternoon that this – I remember them breaking into like soap operas or whatever. Not that I was a big soap opera watcher back then. But as a kid, I just remember that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you talked about Cosmos, and I remember being very young, 3 or 4 years old, and my dad watching Cosmos. And there's that one, the Carl Sagan Cosmos, and there's that one where he's filmed at what looks like Mars. And at my young age, I thought he was on Mars. I remember that very vividly. Well, let me just ask you then personally. What were some of the moments throughout your life? You mentioned the one with shuttling the space shuttle on the back of a Boeing. What were some of the moments throughout your life when space exploration was sort of top of mind? I think of the summer of 2015 when almost 4 years ago now to the day, I think, when we got images of Pluto from New Horizons for the first time. Cassini's intentional demise a couple of years ago. Curiosity rover. What do you remember? What sticks out?
Well, sadly, the Challenger explosion.
Yeah.
You know, that really highlights how dangerous this is. I mean, it's, you know, we've only sent up so many shuttles and a couple of them exploded in the process of going up or coming down. And so the people who do this are incredibly brave and they know what they're signing up for. And that moment obviously stands out growing up. I kind of forgot about how much I loved space until I engaged with this issue starting about a year ago. I forgot how much I loved it as a little boy. And so one of the joys of working on this was reconnecting with this subject. And I mean, I just talked people's ear off over the last 6 months, you know, at cocktail parties. And I'm sure some of them thought I was just being boring, but I had forgotten how much I love this stuff.
If you would have found me at one of those parties, we would have been buddies all night. What about you, Mike?
I've got to say I'm a lot like Daniel. I had lost my connection to space, or rather I feel like I have all the same memories, the same highlights. But I think when I grew up, and Daniel and I are about the same age, somewhere along the line the reality of space exploration was kind of taken over by the fantasy. And by that, I mean Star Wars came out when I was a kid. That's a huge popular culture moment in my life and in the life of a lot of people my age. And I don't want to speak for other people, but for me, somewhere along that arc, I was more interested in Han Solo than, you know, Neil Armstrong. But as I get older and as we approach this anniversary and working on this issue, I have a deep, deep appreciation for the hard work and the bravery and the sheer audacity of what these people did.
We're talking about Indiana's role in space exploration with Indianapolis Monthly's Daniel Comiskey and Mike Rubino. Coming up, we'll hear about Indiana's astronauts with Daniel Comiskey. And, of course, we'll take your questions if you have a personal connection, of course, to Indiana's astronauts. Find us at All In Indiana on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about Indiana's role in space exploration on this, the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11. 4 days later, Purdue grad Neil Armstrong became the first human being to set foot on the lunar surface, an honor bestowed to only 12 people. We're talking with Daniel Comiskey, deputy editor of Indianapolis Monthly, about his profile of Indiana astronauts in the July issue. Daniel Comiskey, you interviewed 5 Hoosier astronauts for the piece, and I loved each profile, but some of these folks were pretty busy. How did you manage to schedule time with these astronauts, and how far did you have to go back to prep?
Yeah, they're tough people to get in touch with. They, you know, when only 500 people have ever been to space, you know, they're in demand. And some, you know, one of them was on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean for 6 months lecturing to scientists. You know, one of them is a CEO of a company in Norway. These are the kinds of lives these people live. So it's not easy to get in touch with them, but it was absolutely worth it. It was one of the greatest joys of the last couple of years working on the magazine, interviewing these folks and the stories they have to tell. You know, space is a pretty exclusive destination, and these people have experiences that just about nobody has ever had.
Well, in so many ways, it changes one's life to go into space. Not just because you then have that label, astronaut or cosmonaut or whatever it is, for the rest of your life, but also you see the Earth from that impossible perspective.
Yeah, that's called the overview effect, and almost all of them experience it. You know, these people are not – they're not poets. They're not, you know, overtly spiritual people. I'm sure some of them are religious, of course, but almost without fail, when they get up there and see the universe at large, they come back with a different perspective. It forces a contemplation that maybe you haven't had before of our role in the universe, how delicate and small our planet is. So they all come back with this sort of meditative experience. They all talked about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and David Wolf is no exception. He had maybe the most dramatic cinematic experience of all of them in getting locked outside the space station.
David Wolf, who graduated from North Central, went to Purdue and has also been, a side note, a frequent guest down the road at the Bob and Tom Show. He had a lot to say about spacewalks, like you said, and his first one was harrowing. Tell me about that.
Well, he was working in the Russian space station Mir, and it was his very first trip to space, and it was going to be his first spacewalk, his first trip outside the station. And he had been out for about 6.5 hours, which is about the limit of a spacesuit in terms of its expendables, in terms of its oxygen, in terms of its carbon dioxide scrubbers that get rid of that poisonous gas that you're breathing out. And so he came back to Mir and entered the the depressurized area of the station, and they couldn't bring it back up to pressure. They couldn't – there was a malfunction. And they tried for a couple of hours to bring this back up to pressure so he could take his helmet off and breathe, and his suit was out of everything. And in the last 90 seconds of life, as he explained it to me, they ditched the plan. They had never practiced this, so they sent him back out. He moved himself, maneuvered himself along the space station outside of it to another part of it that they decided they could make into a makeshift, compartment for him to enter. And they brought it. He was staring through this little window trying to get in. And through the window, he sees – it just happened to be the chamber where he had been sleeping. And he sees a photograph of his family taped to the wall through the window, and he's trapped outside in his last 90 seconds of life. And he thought to himself, well, this is how it ends, I guess. And
can you imagine like seeing photos of your family
and being trapped in the void? he was lucky. You know, they were able to bring that compartment to vacuum very quickly and allow him in and then repressurize it. And he was able to, gasping, to take off the helmet and survive. And it was a very lucky thing to survive. And yet he says, in the moment, it was just another problem to solve. He looks back on it with horror. But in the moment, it was just, what are the 3 or 4 steps right in front of me?
How do we get out of this situation?
Right. And there's a lot of that in space. Things don't go the way you expect them to in space. I mean, there's a lot of planning on the ground, brilliant people there and above. But things just don't go your way. It's a really inhospitable environment, and things don't always perform the way they're supposed to. So there's a lot of ingenuity and sort of quick thinking required in surviving up there.
Serena Aunyan Chancellor, born in Indy. Her dad was an engineer. He taught at Purdue. When he found out that she wanted to be an astronaut, he told her that she should become an engineer. But she went a different route to become an astronaut. Tell me about Serena Aunyan Chancellor.
Well, she's a surgeon, and like all of these people, extremely high achieving individual. You know, these are people for whom being a surgeon is not enough. You know, you have to add a mechanical engineering degree on top of that, and then add NASA training on top of that. And so these are extremely ambitious, high achieving, brilliant people. And she did a lot of scientific work in extreme environments. She worked in underwater laboratories. She worked in Antarctica. And the thinking behind that for NASA is they want to see how you perform in extreme environments, which, of course, space is the ultimate extreme environment, and they want to see when you're cut off from communication, when you're cut off from resources, how do you work under pressure? And obviously she was good at it because they sent her up. She spent 200 days in space last year, and she's not done. One of the cool things about interviewing Serena was that a lot of these astronauts were telling me these crazy great stories about things that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago. Well, she's still doing it, and we'll probably go back. And so, yeah, I had a blast interviewing her, and I learned a lot from her too. She talked about, you know, I didn't know this. When you get to space in that first few minutes or even first few hours, your brain is playing tricks on you because your sense of balance is requires the inner ear, and the inner ear requires gravity. And so as soon as you get to space, it's an 8.5 minute ride up, and as soon as you get there, your whole world feels like it's upside down. Some astronauts report feeling like they're hanging from the ceiling. Some report, in her case, she felt like everything was tilted 45 degrees and kind of blurry. And the brain figures out how to adjust after a period of minutes or hours, but it's pretty disorienting. Mm. And it's just one of the many surprises of space travel, I guess.
We've mentioned that Purdue is considered the cradle of astronauts. 20-some graduates, including Neil Armstrong, of course, went on to become astronauts. And we can't claim Neil Armstrong as a Hoosier. He was born and raised in Ohio, but we can claim Charlie Walker, one of three astronauts from Lawrence County. He was an engineer for McDonnell Douglas who essentially paid for him to go up on the space shuttle and do some work for them back in the mid-'80s.
So you were a student at Purdue during the Apollo program, and so you were there during the first moon landing, and everyone remembers exactly where they were when that happened. Where were you?
Well, it was July, of course, 1969. Since it was summertime, and I was not at school, I was living with my folks during that summer break in our house I grew up in Bedford, Indiana, and so that weekend in July, I was in front of our family black and white television to watch and listen to the landing. I was my third year, or about to start my third year in Purdue Engineering. And so, yes, Apollo was on everybody's mind, but maybe more so at Purdue because Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee, another Purdue engineer, Air Force officer, and then astronaut, were in 1967 killed in the Apollo 1 fire on the launch pad during testing at the Cape. So those Purdue grads were on everybody's minds throughout the continued progress toward a moon landing. The thought was, my gosh, this is great. It's so wonderful that Purdue is involved. Of course, it should be, being a premier engineering school, yada, yada, yada. But it was that kind of sense of just an uplift of enthusiasm for what this country could do and was about to do that was in everybody's mind, I think. And it was, I think, in retrospect, if I had been able to look back and watch myself, I was probably standing and sitting a few inches off the floor. I was so excited.
Well, you yourself went up in the mid-'80s, and since then there have been a lot of non-governmental employees in space, but you were actually the first one, the first commercial astronaut. You were an engineer for McDonnell Douglas at the time. What was that like? Did you feel like you were part of the team?
I felt the difference. NASA executives in Washington, D.C. had policies to expand the American presence in space through industry being there, not just pilots and government employed astronauts, but private industry being there, new jobs, new businesses being created in that unique environment of space. And eventually people going into space are seeing their representatives, even a teacher and a journalist going into space with time. And I was on the leading edge of that because the company I worked for had real business prospects in the use of microgravity, zero gravity, for industrial processes, improving our life and our products by literally controlling gravity in that way through spaceflight. So NASA executives wanted to see this happen. Well, the operational folks, they thought it was their job to help make this happen. And by gosh, they were smart enough to be trained to do anything. But I was, as the first representative in that way, was seen as an outsider. And there was no hazing per se going on, but I certainly could feel attention and see attention. And my response was, hey, your bosses told me and us that this was going to happen, so let's just make it happen. And I think I got respect after my first flight. I had my commander of my third flight on board Space Shuttle say to my face once, as well as to others around me, he says, we know Charlie Walker, and he's trained with us, he's flown with us, he's like one of us. He didn't say he was one of us, but he said he was like one. So, yeah, I felt a difference, but we got along fine.
You're a graduate of Bedford High School, Bachelor of Science from Purdue. Do you still consider yourself a Hoosier?
You bet I do. This is like, you know, I think it's more common in conversation about military service, particularly maybe the Marine Corps. There's no such thing as a former Marine. Well, there's no such thing as a former Hoosier either.
Well, but you don't live here anymore. You live in Arizona, right?
I've got home here in Arizona. Susan, my wife, and myself have now lived here for 10 years. We migrated here from where we were employed in the corporate world, recently posted in the Washington, D.C. area. But I haven't gotten back to Indiana as frequently as I used to. I get back to Indiana a couple of times a year now for both family visits as well as maybe occasional speaking or presentation opportunities or representing something or the other. But it is home, and it's in my head all the time. Every time the word Hoosier or Indiana is in the news, I'm beamed back there, so to speak, mentally and emotionally. So, yeah, I definitely feel the connection every day.
Charlie Walker, the first commercial astronaut, Hoosier. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Matt.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back live in the studio with Daniel Comiskey, deputy editor of Indianapolis Monthly, talking about his profiles of Indiana astronauts in their July issue. Daniel, another astronaut you talked to was Jerry L. Ross, who was raised in Crown Point. He went to Purdue. He's tied for the most launches in history, and he used to be the record holder for the most EVAs or spacewalks. What did he have to say about spacewalks?
Well, he had more experience than almost anybody, obviously, and he said it was his favorite thing to do. To be, you know, the ship can feel confining. Even the space station, which is larger, can feel confining. I'm sure it feels great to get out and to see, you know, everything there is to see in the solar system from that perspective. He had a really interesting history. His first mission was to carry up some communication satellites, which is a pretty common story. Jerry was lucky. He joined NASA at exactly the right moment. The reason he took seven trips is because he joined right at the beginning of the shuttle program and stayed a long career over three decades to the very end of the shuttle program. So he just happened to be there at the right time to take the most trips. And one of his defining achievements was he helped lay a couple of the first pieces of the International Space Station. You know, that wasn't something we brought up there and put together in 2 hours.
It wasn't an IKEA thing.
No, it happened over like 7-8 years, and he helped lay the cornerstones of that thing. And now we have astronauts living in it pretty much year round. So, as do a couple other nations.
Speaking of the International Space Station, you also talked to Kevin Ford from Montpelier, Indiana, Notre Dame undergrad. I believe he flew four missions, and the first of which was to deliver a very important piece of equipment to the International Space Station.
Yeah, the Colbert, the treadmill that the astronauts use up there. I believe actually the Colbert is no longer in use. I think it served about a 10-year life in space and is now broken. Stephen Colbert somehow convinced them to name the thing after him, and that's what he brought up on one of his first missions. Exercise is really important in space. I mean, your muscles atrophy very quickly in that environment when you're not using them because you're in microgravity. You just don't need them. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the exception of your hands and a couple of things, you know, you use most of your muscles that require, you know, you require here on Earth walking around. They just atrophy because you're not using them. So they all spend a couple, 2-3 hours a day exercising, whether it be treadmill or lifting resistance bands, because of course weights are useless in space. So Yeah, it's more important than it sounds.
Kevin Ford also was given an interesting role in Russia back in the mid-2000s as the director of operations at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center in Russia. And he gave you the classic astronaut's perspective statement, which I never tire of. And so tell me what he said about looking down at the Earth.
He said that he had the distinct feeling we're really vulnerable, you know, that the Earth is small. It's only 7,000 miles across. That sounds kind of like a lot here, but it's pretty tiny as the solar system and universe go. And you know, especially looking at the atmosphere, which we often sort of just don't think about at all, right? It's sort of invisible. But when you're in space, you can see the atmosphere. You can see that thin layer of gas that holds the oxygen in. So this is a livable planet and burns up most of the small asteroids that hit us. You know, the moon looks like it does for a reason. It doesn't have an atmosphere, mm-hmm. right? And in the Earth's early development, we didn't have one either. And we're constantly getting hammered by asteroids that didn't – that now, you know, the smaller ones burn up because of our atmosphere. So it does a lot for us, and it's very thin. He said it looks so thin it seems like a light breeze could blow it away. And if it ever did, we'd all be gone.
Well, and just real quick, speaking of spacewalks, there is a great step-by-step in the July issue of Indianapolis Monthly that illustrates – what goes into each spacewalk based on protocols set by another Purdue grad, Alyssa Battacletti-Nofke, known affectionately by NASA as the Spacewalk Professor. Well, coming up next, we'll talk about Neil Armstrong with writer Adam Wren, and we'll take a look at the Indiana companies who have and still are taking us into space. And of course, we'll take your questions and comments for our panel via social media. You can find us at All In Indiana on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're discussing Indiana's role in space research and exploration with the help of Indianapolis Monthly, who's marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing with a series of pieces in their July issue. And right now, we're going to talk with writer Adam Wren, who wrote about Neil Armstrong for the magazine. Adam, we learned that Neil Armstrong initially had his sights on another school.
That's right. That's right. Well, good to be with you, Matt. Yeah. Neil Armstrong, when he was in high school, was trying to figure out where to go to college. And he grew up in Wapakoneta, Ohio, not too far, actually, from where I grew up. And he was a big Ohio State University Buckeye fan. And in his senior year of high school, he went to an OSU-Purdue football game. And much to his surprise, Purdue lambasted Ohio State University, as they did last season as well. And that really made up his mind. So it was one of the most important college football games in the history of the earth, you might say, because that ultimately led him to choose Purdue University. And the rest is quite literally history.
Well, and of course, we learned that he never really had aspirations to become an astronaut. He just wanted to be a test pilot.
That's right. He never really saw himself as an explorer. When he was at Purdue University, he was sort of, you know, led a very mundane lifestyle as a student. He was in band, fraternity life. Friends kind of describe him as happy-go-lucky. And he never quite saw himself as being the first person to set foot on the moon.
Adam, I'm curious. Did you see the movie First Man?
I did.
What did you think?
I enjoyed the movie a lot. I was sort of struck by the heaviness placed on the family members of the astronauts in the early days of the Apollo missions, and sort of the weight that they bore, and the weight that Neil Armstrong in the film seemed to bear as well. But if you look at his time at Purdue University, his biographer, you know, kind of says that that wasn't really quite the man that you saw in West Lafayette at the time.
We're talking with Adam Wren via Skype, who put together a piece starting talking about Neil Armstrong. And then you also talk about who might be the next Neil Armstrong in the piece in the Indianapolis Monthly July issue. As you point out, this month not only marks 50 years since Neil Armstrong's first moon landing, but also 150 years since the founding of Purdue University itself. So there's a lot going on in West Lafayette this year. Can you tell me what's happening in October?
Yeah, that's right. You know, they are bringing together a number of former astronauts and a number of people involved in the space program there. And they will be, you know, looking at Neil Armstrong exhibits that have some of the former astronauts, you know, the belongings. As a matter of fact, today in Washington, D.C., where I'm calling from right now, the Vice President of the United States, former Indiana Governor Mike Pence, actually rolled out Neil Armstrong's spacesuit at the National Air and Space Museum here. So we'll be seeing months of sort of celebration of this, both in Washington, D.C. and in West Lafayette.
Gosh, I wonder how we can get to go to that astronaut reunion in West Lafayette.
That's right. That's right. Well, the university has produced 22 astronauts. So it's a veritable astronaut factory. And now they're sort of producing the next generation of astronaut, which looks a little bit different than sort of the Neil Armstrongs and Gus Grissoms of the previous NASA.
Yeah, the rest of your piece not only details more about Neil Armstrong himself, but also it goes right into who might be the next Neil Armstrong. Four profiles, three of whom are women, all Purdue students or graduates. A fascinating read. Can you kind of give a summary of what's in there?
Sure. Yeah. So the kind of astronaut that NASA is looking for has changed over the last 50 years. You know, it started out where they wanted military test pilots, and in fact, a very specific kind of military test pilot. Because of the size of the space capsule, they could only take astronauts who were 5'11 or shorter. And now, you know, with design and our changing mission in space, that kind of astronaut that they're looking for has changed. Essentially, there are only a few requirements, broad-based requirements that NASA has for an astronaut now. They want someone who has an undergrad STEM degree, which Purdue produces a lot of graduates who have that distinction. They want someone who has roughly 1,000 hours of flight training and someone who's a U.S. citizen. And then it gets really competitive from there. An American actually has a better chance of getting struck by lightning than they do getting selected to be a NASA astronaut. About 1 in 3,000 Americans are struck by lightning in every year, and fewer than those are selected for the NASA space program. But more than ever, NASA is selecting a diverse class of astronauts. In 2017, they selected their most diverse class yet. And increasingly, those astronauts are women with STEM degrees. And Purdue University has done a really good job of growing the number of female STEM candidates that they have. And that's kind of why we sort of focused on potential female astronauts. NASA has also said that the first person to step foot back on the moon in this decade will include a woman, and also the Mars mission that we're planning later this decade, or perhaps early in 2030, will include a female traveler as well. So it looks like, just from my reporting, that the history of manned space travel is actually female.
Writer Adam Wren from Indianapolis Monthly joining us via Skype. Thanks so much, Adam, for your for the piece, and I encourage everyone to check it out.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Matt.
Let's shift the focus to the companies in Indiana who are or have been involved in space exploration and research. Mike Rubino, one of your writers, Tony Rehagen, did a great profile on many of those Indiana companies that have had a hand in it. And since we're kind of using history as an excuse for this conversation, mm-hmm. Let's talk about Allison Engine Company, a rich history dating back to the founding of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. They eventually also got into airplane engines, which sort of led them to a NASA contract. What'd they build for NASA?
Yeah, they built titanium fuel tanks, basically. And so they built about 200 of these, a little more than 200 of these, that were used in the Apollo missions. Actually, a couple of them are still on the moon, which I think is really cool. More than a couple.
More than
of them,
a couple.
They're like 28 of them. So there's a piece of Indiana on the moon, and that Allison piece of it is the historical antecedent, I think, to what you see today, and that is we have a great manufacturing industry in Indiana. And skilled labor, the people who knew how to weld those titanium tanks, are the reason Allison had the contract in the first place. And so today, if you get a bridge yesterday and today, you see dozens of small Indiana companies, small to mid-size, who are doing these little things. And not that they're unimportant, they're essential to the overall mission. So it's kind of a sum of its parts thing. There are companies in South Bend. There are companies in Indianapolis, major tool and machine in Indianapolis, MTI in South Bend, Imagineering Finishing Technologies in South Bend. There are things down south in Paoli, and I think you get to have something a little bit later on from TechShot. All these companies are doing the essential. I'm going to use a sports analogy. They're setting the picks. They're grabbing the rebounds. They are doing kind of the unsung work of space travel. So, I think when you look at all this and everything that we've been talking today, the thing I want the listeners to come away with, and what I wanted our readers to come away with, is that you cannot tell the story of Apollo 11 without Indiana. You cannot tell the story, the past of space exploration in this country without Indiana. And you cannot tell the future of space exploration without Indiana. And as a Hoosier or as someone who lives here, that should make you very proud. There are over 25 companies who are contributing to those next missions that Adam talked about, missions that will take us to the moon, perhaps take us to an asteroid, and ultimately to Mars. And I think that's really cool.
You mentioned the future. The piece talks about everything down to the switches on the Orion multipurpose crew vehicle. You talked about going to Mars. You talked about going to an asteroid. I think this is the vehicle that is at least going to have a hand in getting us there.
Yeah.
The switches were made at JFW Industries in Southport.
Yeah.
And Muncie's Liftalof Corporation made the aerial platforms, and a number of other companies, of course, are mentioned. And the point is made that Indiana is kind of a one-stop shop for space manufacturing.
Yeah, that was the biggest takeaway I had from Tony Rehagen. Did a great job with that story, and that was the biggest takeaway I had from it. That and again, a big sense of pride that we have such a skilled community here to be able to do that, and that we're playing such an essential role in this thing that we can look back on and have. It's not only just pride. It's something that should propel us forward. But the beginning of all this, I said that, you know, I do have space memories, but as I get older, I'm really just kind of proud and in awe of the audacity to send somebody to the moon.
There's a company in Greenville, Indiana called TechShot with a very curious and kind of funny beginning who are doing something amazing, truly amazing in space. And I talked with their VP of corporate advancement, Rich Bowling, about the company.
I love the genesis of TechShot. Eighth grader enters a science fair sponsored by NASA, wants to do an experiment with chicken embryos in space. A few years pass, the same student's now a freshman at Purdue, and NASA wants to do it. Not only that, Kentucky Fried Chicken wants to sponsor it. This was back in the 80s. There is a sad element to the story in that the experiment was aboard the Challenger when it exploded, but it eventually made it in 1989, and TechShot was born. Without dwelling too much on the past, there are a lot of interesting stories behind what you guys do there in Greenville.
You know, we're having a good time, and which is not to be, undervalued. I think if you want to be in the space industry and you live in Indiana, you want to work at TechShot. We're doing a lot of amazing things, and the two co-founders are still here. So that kid with the chicken embryo experiment, he still runs the company. So it's amazing to come to work every day with these folks.
Well, you essentially solve problems. NASA or some other entity has an idea for an experiment, and you guys just figure it out.
That's it. So, you know, I sort of liken us to, in one sense, Levi Strauss and Company in 1853. So the denim jeans, that didn't happen for 20 years. That was 1873. 1853, Levi Strauss sold picks and shovels to miners in the gold rush fields. And so the science, the research that's going on in space, most of it, with one exception, most of it is not our research, right? We provide those high-tech picks and shovels that folks from NASA, folks from universities, or even companies like Eli Lilly use those picks and shovels, high-tech picks and shovels, in space to dig for their own discoveries.
I love that analogy. Now, you're headed to Florida for not only the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, but you're also there to oversee a launch with some of your equipment on it. Can you tell me what's about to go up?
Sure. So, you know, we actually, because of the activity level we're at now, we have something that launches on pretty much every cargo ship that goes to the International Space Station. And so that may be a Northrop Grumman cargo ship that launches from Virginia, or in this case, a SpaceX cargo ship that launches from Cape Canaveral. And so we have a couple of things on board. One of them is for a customer, one of these examples I talked about, where we provide the high-tech picks and shovels. And so that's actually, in this case, a researcher at NASA in Silicon Valley, NASA Ames Research Center. That researcher is looking at some bacteria growth. And, you know, you can study a lot of things on tiny little organisms like bacteria or even fruit flies that you can extrapolate the impact and the effect to even to human beings. I mean, the 75% of the diseases that affect a fruit fly affect a human. So the astronauts, you don't really want to test on them that much. So if you can test it on some bacteria or a fruit fly, then that's what you want to do. And so that research is going on inside a piece of equipment we already have on board the station. We're just launching the samples to be put inside that equipment. And then we're launching our what we call our BFF, which is the second thing launching on that vehicle. And that's a 3D printer.
Yeah, that's one thing that you guys are working on, and it's profiled briefly in the Indianapolis Monthly piece, which you should read because it's incredible. Can you tell me more about the BFF?
Right. So the BFF, so that's the TechShot 3D biofabrication facility, and it's literally a bioprinter designed to make human tissue aboard the International Space Station. And obviously, this is the proverbial journey of 1,000 miles. So we're not going to be making you a new heart or liver tomorrow, but the BFF is that first step. And we will literally be 3D printing cardiac tissue in this case, heart tissue. And eventually we're going to increase in thickness over time to where we're making thicker and thicker tissue, more complex tissue. And yes, at the end of the day, if that day is 10 years from now, we want to be attempting whole organs at least.
And there's something about zero G, which is really kind of the point of a lot of the experiments that you guys are contracted out to do. Zero G in this case, it makes it a little bit easier.
Well, I think we would say it makes it even possible. So on Earth, you may have seen people who 3D print human types of tissue like cartilage, an ear or the tip of a nose, or maybe even a meniscus from a knee. But those things don't have very many cells in them. The cartilage and bone is a little easier to do. But when you really want to print thick tissue, something like skin or liver tissue, heart tissue, so forth, on Earth, when you print that, it just sort of collapses and turns into a puddle. When you print with bio inks, of course, a printer has ink. So our bio inks on the ground have such low viscosity, that is, they're not much thicker than water, that when you print them, they just sort of, they're like a runny egg, which you need to have structure, right, and shape. But when you add in various chemicals to make that tissue hold its shape, those chemicals are lethal to the tissue. So you can't really have it both ways. However, if you 3D print in space, that tissue will hold its shape just fine. We proved that by doing a number of experiments on an aircraft that makes these parabolic arcs in the sky. So you may have seen people who float around about 25 seconds at a time.
The Vomit Comet.
You got it. The Vomit Comet. Yeah. I will tell you that our team of five folks who flew on the Vomit Comet Absolutely none of them lost their lunch. So they're so proud of that. I may have an opportunity to fly later this year on that. And the bar is set pretty high. And between you and me, I kind of get a little motion sickness, but I'm not going to tell them that because I really want to fly on this vehicle. So the magic combination no one's tried before that might print you a new tissue someday, 10 or 15 years from now.
It's just amazing. I can't believe it. I can't believe what's going on down in Greenville, Indiana. Well, Rich, I hope you get to ride the Vomit Comet, and you're on your way out to the launch. Good luck with that. Rich
Thanks.
Bowling, VP of Corporate Advancement at TechShot Incorporated in Greenville, Indiana. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
What a great note to end on. Indiana is 3D printing heart tissue in space.
It's crazy.
What a time to live in. I want to thank our guests from Indianapolis Monthly, Deputy Editor Daniel Comiskey.
Thank you.
And Editor-in-Chief Mike Rubino, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a real honor.
Of course, the July issue is out now. I would encourage you to check it out. Thursday on All In, we'll get the latest on the controversy in South Bend surrounding the shooting of a black man by a white police officer in a town whose mayor is running for president. We'll be joined by reporter Justin Hicks, who's been covering the story for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and Andrew Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics about the political implications. Until then, we'll take your questions and comments about that on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.